These are pretty amazing days to be alive. Like, I feel most days really, really grateful to live where and when I do. Not all the time. I'm not going to get into the negative side of that. Y'all can make your own list. But most of the time, that's how I feel. And one of the reasons I feel that way is because it feels like we try to kind of annually do a family photograph in our household. And usually it's just a weekend when we can have everybody home. And this was that weekend. And so we have four kids. I'll talk more about them in a moment. But when we lined everybody up, one of the kids was like standing beside me and they kind of reached down, you know, and put their arm around me. They're like, hey, little dad, you know, like they're all like these giants, right? These huge people and amazing human beings. And that's one of the things that I love about the age that we live in. I just feel like this era is producing some amazing kids. It seems like every week there's something in the news cycle about some kid that's launching a fundraising campaign, or they're working on cleaning up their neighborhood, or they're collecting something for a better world kind of cause. Like, there's just always seems like there's something like that going on. Kareen and I have, we have four children. Two of them have more or less launched, although if this weekend's any indication, they sure don't mind coming home for dinner, or cash, or laundry, or whatever, you know, but they're not living at home anymore. And the other two are 17 and 14, and so there's no littles at home anymore. But a couple of weeks ago, here at the table, some small person was having a crisis, and their parent looked at me and said, do you remember this part? And I said yes, which was true, and then I thought about it later, and I felt really grateful for how that part's fading, you know. Now, honestly, how many of us would have gotten into the really big things in our life, the really big commitments in our life, if we'd known all the details? Like, that doesn't mean they're bad, right? But honestly, like, it's love that gets us in there, often as not. And then what we start to discover along the way is that lots of days, love is more of a verb than a noun. It's more like a bunch of choices than a bundle of feelings. And we kind of have to live our way into that, right? But if we're parents, or if we're involved as uncles, aunts, friends in caring, nurturing relationships with young people, with kids, then we know something about what it feels like to want to raise good kids. We know what it feels like to want to try to raise kids that know themselves, kids that care about other people, kids that want to make the world a better place, kids that aren't afraid to work at that. And we can know what that feels like to want to be a part of that. And so we wrestle with how to do that, and we try to do that the best that we can. Before Kareen and I had children, because we got married a little later than some of our friends did, there was already little people around in our friendship circle, and I remember one of my friends saying to me, you know, being a parent is basically guilt. And I wasn't a parent, and I was like, oh yeah? Well, that's too bad for you, you know? Well, it's not going to be like that way when I'm a parent. I don't think I've ever gone back to them and said, you were right, I'm sorry, but I probably should. Because we know what that feels like, right? We know what it feels like to try to do our best and feel like, ah, man, I don't think that was it. I don't think that was my best just then. And I now, of course, I'm, you know, of the vintage where my friends are becoming grandparents. It's not going to happen to us anytime soon as far as anybody that can contribute is saying. But the word on the street is that it's awesome because you don't have to worry about how you're going to screw them up, right? You're just like, yep, well, this is a complicated moment. Back to mom and dad, you know, and you just, so you just get the best part. You don't have that other really challenging part where you're wondering, how do I do this? How do I do this? How do I actually bring my best to this? Well, if you're a parent here this morning, I wouldn't be surprised if you come to or may have already come to this point where, with your children, where you realize that whatever influence you're going to have, you have now had. And it's past tense, and it's sort of over to you. You know? It's not that there's no love, but that I'm the big jug and you're the little jug sensation that sometimes we have as parents, that it's done. And you're in the next season. And that can be a scary realization sometimes, but I think it can also be a very hopeful one. And not the least of the reasons why it can be scary is because that moment where we kind of hand it over, I think that calls for something really unique from us if we're a parent. That's not a grief-free moment, even if it's what you've been working for the whole time. So it's complicated. We're going to come back to that thought shortly, but I want to do something a little different to help us enter that space this morning. I want to read you somebody else's story about how they faced that moment as a parent and about the very hopeful lessons that they came away from it with. And I'm going to read this for you in its entirety, and it's a whole page long. The good news is the person who wrote it is a writer, so it's well written and quite lovely. McLean's, for a long time, did something in the very back where it was essentially an obituary, but fleshed out as a story. And they've kind of shifted gears to include something that they're calling Before You Go. So opportunities for people to say things to significant folks in their lives before those people are no longer here to say them to in person. So this is one of those Before You Goes, and it's just called Dear Lucy. When Lucy was a tiny child, all of 4 years old, and this is written by her father, I should say. When Lucy was a tiny child, all of 4 years old, I took her to see the Nutcracker Suite in Toronto. And there she was in her party dress, perched enthusiastically on her booster seat and leaning in as if magnetized to the ballet. When the music ended, the audience applauded, and we left. She was so exquisitely happy. But then she began to cry. She became a little ball of weeping and sorrow, and it was as if my life was collapsing before me. Why, Lucy, why? Because, she said in between gulps for air, because it's stopped and it's finished, more agonizing sobs, and I don't want the magic to be over. I don't want the magic to end. Now, it was my turn to feel tearful, but I managed to reply, darling, I promise you with all I have that the magic will never end. It was an enormous promise to make. The kind of earnest, naive promise that parents deploy, which in the eyes of the child only burnish our mythical status. But it's also the promise that infers a type of control that parents eventually come to realize they simply do not have. Then the child turns into the teenager who becomes the young woman who is now the beautiful, brilliant 28-year-old who has lived everywhere from New Zealand to Paris, Oxford to Canterbury, and now she's getting married in September. I will give a speech at her wedding, but I don't know what I will tell her. I want to tell her in the simplest of terms that I love her, but that phrase feels weak here. It's a phrase so often used and abused to sum up, to justify, and even to forgive an ocean of emotions and actions. What I feel is more complex than that. After all, the common conception of parental love is one that's superior, protective, even condescending. But in reality, a parent's relationship with a child is symbiotic. Any mother or father who assumes that they are the exclusive guide and guard of their child should think again. Children make the world appear much more dangerous and vulnerable, but also far more exciting and new again. They teach just as much as we do. Instead of, I love you, I want to tell Lucy what a father's love for a daughter, that a father's love for a daughter means knowing when one is wrong. Letting go instead of holding on, and seeing the autonomous splendor in a child instead of trying to glorify an ideal of the parent. Parental love is rejoicing in the shock of the new and singing the songs and poetry of a new generation that does not belong to us. Instead of, I love you, I want to tell Lucy that she's changed me. Years ago, when I was a new father to this young daughter, I was a comfortable, complacent, social conservative, and an orthodox Roman Catholic. Not only was I adamant in my beliefs, I was known to be vocally so. On the radio, in newspaper columns, and beyond, I put forth an aggressive and uncompromising defense of that Roman Catholic orthodoxy, which held that gay marriage was unacceptable, among other things. And while it was not intended to be hateful, it certainly enabled hate. I know now I caused people pain. But 5 years ago, I had a radical transformation, at its heart forged by a spiritual and religious conversion, layered with a succession of experiences, and by my relationship with Lucy. Despite my beliefs, and despite her longtime rejection of organized religion, she was never didactic and never asked for any change. But by watching her relationships, interactions, and exquisite leaps of tolerance and understanding, I was obliged to hold up a mirror to my ideas, beliefs, and, yes, painful as it is to admit, my prejudices. Her attitudes and relationships liberated me, and frankly, her wisdom shamed me. When I embraced equal marriage, social liberalism, and what some see as a revolutionary form of Christianity, Lucy said to me, "Dad, I would never have asked you to do this, but I am so, so glad that you have. I am so happy." I went to my study and wept. Lucy, my darling, I know that I, like my parents who are gone now, but who I wish could have seen their precious granddaughter be married, will not be with you forever. But please know that I have done what I could, and I tried my inadequate best, and that I am more proud of you than I could ever say. And know that what I told you more than two decades ago still holds true, not because of anything I could ever do, but because as long as you want it to be so, the magic never ends. The music may stop, the dance will finish, and the curtains may draw, but the magic never ends. When I say I love you on your wedding day, I will mean all of this. When I first read that article, and I mean, it was in Maclean's. It wasn't in Christianity Today. It's interesting, right? The context was part of the impact for me. It really impacted me. I'd never heard of the author, but from some of the preamble to the article, it seemed like they were a well-known figure, so I looked them up. And what I discovered is that this guy has changed more than I could have ever guessed, even with the content of the letter in hand. He's not only made the sort of changes within his own religion that he touches on in the letter, but has publicly apologized for a book that he wrote on Islam. And he acknowledges in the letter, his previously what he calls aggressive and uncompromising defense of orthodoxy, his intent was not to be hateful, but as he says, it enabled hate. Now, for a public figure, this person is a journalist, a broadcaster, somebody who's been a published book writer, somebody who's been not just uncompromising about their stance on certain things, but very, very public. For them to actually come to some of those positional things and speak of that kind of a change of heart and mind and life, that's not the sort of thing that's in the news cycle very often. That's not the sort of thing that happens easily. My point here is not to get into the details of Michael Corn's work or even his change of mind and heart, despite the fact that from my vantage point, those changes seem like very good news. I think that probably anyone in this room that has ever had to face into changing a system of belief or even into the reconsideration of a deeply held conviction or practice knows that that sort of change is hugely challenging. It doesn't ever just happen. There needs to be a catalyst. And the more deeply held, the more, I would say, even unconsciously practiced the thing is that's being reconsidered, the more substantial the catalyst needs to be. This is hugely challenging stuff. In Michael Corrin's life, that catalyst has been his daughter, his child. As it goes, I am someone for whom the Christian story provides my most familiar way of thinking about God. Those are the stories that I grew up steeped in. And so because of that, I can't help when I think about this story and about these kind of things, I can't help but think about how Jesus pointed to children as somehow exemplifying the very best ways to connect with God. And a lot of those statements of Jesus are quite enigmatic to our Western 21st century ears, but they're not complicated sentences. Unless you become like a little child, Jesus says to his followers, you can't know what it's like to live close to God. Sorry, I rather thought the complicated business of living close to God was reserved for, you know, the big people. Jesus was adamant about children not being second-class citizens, and this was in a culture that was, at best, dismissive of the young. As a teacher, as an influencer of culture, Jesus expressed considerable dismay and even anger when those who claimed to follow his way wanted to keep children from his presence and made it clear to him that they regarded the adults and their issues as more important than the children and theirs. And despite Jesus' constant insistence that his path was a way of peace, he uses some rather violent imagery to communicate just how utterly unacceptable it was for an adult to harm a child, going so far as to suggest that it would be better if such a person were to be removed from interacting with the rest of us in the world. In Jesus' context, considering those concepts, being open to those ways of thinking would have been a huge challenge. It would have been an invitation to a life-altering reconsideration of the world around you and how to live well in it. Corin says in his letter to Lucy, I think he says it well when he says that the common conception of parental love being superior, protective, even condescending, lacks complexity because it fails to appreciate the symbiotic, I would add the mutually interdependent nature of the relationship between a parent and a child. As he says it, they, our children, teach just as much as we do. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to participate together in what we would call here a parent-child dedication. We will have the opportunity together as a community to speak words of hope and blessing to Aaron and Seema and Maya, and they're going to have the chance to speak the same to their daughter. And I want to be very clear about something this morning. There are lots of ways that we could do this. There's nothing sort of magical or more right about this one. It's more like a doorway. It's more like something that we can walk through to get to the really important stuff, which is how we share life together. In this particular case, focusing on how we share life together with Aaron and Seema and their family, their kids, how we love one another, how we care for one another, so that this next generation, the children in our midst, can grow up surrounded by this unshakable conviction that there is great good, that there is great love to be found in the world. I'm going to say everywhere in the world, which I would regard, I realize, as a statement that requires some faith on some days. But so that they grow up surrounded by that conviction so deeply that it can't be taken away from them. And that somehow in that process, they would also be nurtured in the idea that this good, which we might seek through our notions about God, is never, ever, ever going to abandon them. So in terms of the initiative of goodness, goodness will never turn away from them. We can choose to turn away from what's good. We're agents in the story. But goodness won't turn away from us. I believe that if community is anything significant, it is a place where we can nurture that. That's our job. Our job is to keep all of us, including as equal players, moving deeper and deeper into that goodness. You ask a child for their thoughts about love or about goodness, they will have some, and some of them will startle you. I should also say that this blessing that we're going to share together just very shortly references the way of Christ as a path to that, what I've been trying to describe. And if that is not your path, I hope that you can encounter that part of what we're going to do together as an acknowledgement either of the path that you have chosen or of the path that you seek, and just experience that as an invitational part of what we do together rather than as an exclusive part of what we do together this morning.